Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. This week, we have a special guest and a special guest host. The former is poet, essayist, and playwright Claudia Rankine, author of Just Us, An American Conversation, out today from Grey Wolf Press. She will be joined in conversation by our very own editor-in-chief, Tom Beer. Just Us is a paradigm-shifting, cross-disciplinary collection of essays, poems, scholarship, and images contending with the perceptual and experiential divide between Black and white Americans. Here's a bit from our starred review. Just Us is, quote, a passionate and persuasive case about many of the complex mechanics of race in this country, especially how white people barely acknowledge it, particularly in conversation with other white people, while for Black people it affects everything. Rankine writes with disarming intimacy and searing honesty about pointed exchanges with white friends and colleagues, fissures within her marriage, and encounters with white strangers who assume some sort of superiority of rank. Throughout this potent book, the author ably conveys the urgency of the stakes regarding race in America, which many white people fail to acknowledge as an issue. The way she challenges those close to her, risking those relationships, shows readers just how critical the issues are to her and to us. End quote. Starred review. Claudia Rankine is a professor at Yale University and a MacArthur Fellow. Her book, Citizen, An American Lyric, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's the author of the plays The White Card and Help. She and Tom will join us in conversation soon. But first, in an interview sponsored by Amazon Crossing, I'm speaking with Swedish hip-hop star Jason Diakite, author of A Drop of Midnight. Born to interracial American parents in Sweden, Jason Diakite grew up between worlds, part Swedish, American, Black, white, Cherokee, Slovak, and German, riding a delicate cultural and racial divide. It was a no-man's land that left him in constant search of self. Even after his hip-hop career took off, Jason fought to unify a complex system of family roots that branched across continents, ethnicities, classes, and eras to find a sense of belonging. What he found was a story only he can tell. Read or listen to Jason Diakite's moving memoir, A Drop of Midnight, for free with Amazon Prime. Visit amazon.com/adropofmidnight. Welcome, Jason, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Megan. I'm so happy to be here. It's such an honor to be on your show and to talk about my book, A Drop of Midnight.
This book is subtitled here in the States, a memoir. To me, it reads like a collective biography, a family biography, and cultural criticism, and a memoir. But it contains multitudes, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Do you have an official characterization of it, or is that important?
It isn't really important to me, other than it's, of course, of the utmost importance to me that this book, my story, my family's story, reach as many readers as possible. I think most authors would like for that to happen now. And maybe calling it a memoir at least gives somebody who's just glancing at the cover an inkling of what to expect or so. But I'm a little opposed to it being a memoir because it's not my memoir. It's not, just my story. It, as you say, and correctly so, it's my family's story. And it's also a book asking the questions of belonging and identity. I'd say it's a coming of identity novel, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
Unknotting, you know, all these threads that make up who we are and in our heritage, our legacy, and where we come from. and trying to find some answers in that when you're the son of migrants, raised in a country that your parents do not come from. And also, of course, the question of race has been so significant in my view of society and society's view of me, and how I've kind of gauged myself living in a country like Sweden, but also just as a citizen of the world. It's something that I carry with me wherever I go. Of course, it's the most visible part about me. So yeah, it has a lot more layers than I think really fit into the typical description memoir or typical genre of memoir. But in Swedish, it was actually called family biography, was the genre they called it, which I also thought was a little kind of clinical. But who was I to argue? I was so happy to get published that I wasn't going to argue too much with my publishers, you know?
Yeah.
I get pushed, but only so far.
Yeah. It's funny, wow. It's funny because to me, if I were just talking to a friend about your book, which I will be doing, I would say this is like one of the most American stories I ever read, and it's written in Swedish. And yeah. it's by an author who's born in Sweden, but there is so much richness here. And there is a complexity of identity that is, I think, more reflective of an American story than, you know, a lot of the stuff that I read growing up. You know, you get like the founding fathers biography, Ben Franklin, he flew a kite, you know, like that was that's what I had to read. You know?
That's how he discovered electricity.
Yeah. You know.
No, I hear you. And that's really what I hope is going to spark the interest of readers in America, and not just America, but in the English speaking world, which is most of the world, of course, but specifically American readers, is the fact that it is very much an American story. My family is American. My mom and dad are American. But it also, our story loops into Europe via this migration that my parents undertook, and that I think gives us all, you know, both my mom and dad and myself, of course, a different perspective on the United States and what it means to be American and how we view the country. I think from all the times living and visiting the United States, you know, my dad's family is from New York City. So a lot of and I've lived in New York for a couple of years myself. When you're in New York, it feels like New York City, the five boroughs are the universe. They're the entire planet. And then the rest of the country. So like New York City gets 85% of your attention. The rest of the country gets 12 and a half minutes. And the rest of the world, there's only 2.5 minutes left, you know? So I think that coming from a small country like Sweden and in the periphery of Europe, we are, or I was at least, very, it was very important for me to have a very global perspective, to know what was going on in other countries, and of course, mainly the United States. In another way than I think, if I just vastly generalize, than most Americans. You know, it's like my grandfather said to my dad when my dad said he was going to move to Sweden, my grandfather being a waiter that had migrated from South Carolina to Harlem and only once in his life left the United States, and that was to go to Canada. And as he told my dad, it wasn't worth visiting. So he actually regretted that trip. But he did say to my dad, why do you want to move to Sweden? Anybody who is somebody comes to New York City, and if they don't, you don't want to know them. So I kind of think that frames it very well on perspective. So hopefully my book, which is rooted in the United States, I say that I'm of the United States, but I'm not from the United States, gives kind of an insider's outsider view of this story that has been told many times, of race and identity in the United States and and the roots and legacy of slavery that, of course, today are as current and visible as they've ever been in the United States. So that's what my hope for this book in reaching readership in the United States is.
Right. That was Jason Diakite, author of A Drop of Midnight, a memoir, out now from Amazon Crossing. Read or listen to Jason's moving memoir, A Drop of Midnight, for free with Amazon Prime. Visit amazon.com/adropofmidnight. And now, Tom Beer talks with Claudia Rankin, author of Just Us.
Claudia Rankin joins us now from New Haven. Welcome, Claudia, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
This book just is so rich and extraordinary. I read it all the way through, underlining, and then I went back and reread sections and underlined more. And it just does that thing that I love in a book, which is that it just seems to get richer and show you new things about itself as you read it. So thank you very much for writing this book. I think it's really coming along at a momentous time. So I wondered if we could start by just having you read a passage. And I think you said you'd like to read something from the beginning, the what if poem that's at the beginning. Would you read that for us?
I'll read the first page of What If. What does it mean to want an age-old call for change, not to change, and yet also to feel bullied by the call to change? How is a call to change named shame, named penance, named chastisement? How does one say, what if, without reproach? The root of chastise is to make pure. The impossibility of that. Is that what repels and not the call for change?
That's wonderful. So the book is, like so much of your work, it's really a diverse creature. It has things that we might read as essays. It has very poetic passages like that. And sometimes the lines between the two are blurred. How did you come to settle on this way of writing? That you also use it in Citizen and some of your other works. How did you come to that?
Well, I think that I'm a poet by training, but I also write essays and I have written plays. And each genre gives you something different in terms of what it allows. And I thought for this book it would be really amazing if I could bring all my worlds into the one book, so that Claudia, the researcher, the person interested in archival documents, the person who writes poetry, the person who writes essays, could meet inside this inquiry around what conversations about race form, what difficulties, what levels of uncomfortable environments get created, how do you negotiate that? And it did feel like a big enough subject that it needed everything I knew. I was going to throw the kitchen sink at it. So I did.
Yeah. And, one of the things I love about it is I feel this topic of talking about race in America, talking about whiteness, it really requires us to break out of our preconceived little ways of seeing things and understanding things. And you're playing around with form and throwing things together that we might not expect really forces the reader to kind of be more on his or her toes and unsettled a little bit, but in a good way of being open and receptive and thinking outside the box. So I want to talk for a minute about the title. Really, I want to ask you about the subtitle. The title of the book is Just Us, An American Conversation. The idea of a conversation really runs through the whole book. It's a theme. Conversations that you have with white men in certain places about whiteness and white privilege. Conversations that you have with fellow artists and writers, people of color, about race and racism. And one of the things that really was provocative to me and just made me think differently was what it means to have a conversation. Could you say a little something about why you wanted that to be the title and what it means to have a conversation in America today?
Well, you know, I think we have seen that when race is on the table, when we're talking about white supremacy, notions around white supremacy, racism, inequities, everybody clamps up. And at first I thought it was a kind of belligerence, but I have come to believe that we have such different experiences that, you know, when a white person says to me, "What do you mean this happens? I can't believe this happens." It really, what they're really saying to me is, "This has never happened to me." And so I find it hard to believe you. And and so this idea that we're living these parallel realities was something I wanted to replicate inside the conversation. Because, you know, you come to conversations usually, like our conversation now, to learn from each other, to build something, not to be wrong or right, but to really kind of construct a world in which I tell you something, you tell me something, and we move forward from that. And that kind of building and mutual interests that governs other conversations seem to be stalled in talking about race in this country, especially if it's in terms of whiteness. I think white people have spent entire lifetimes not understanding that their whiteness is constructed and that they have investments because of that construction.
Yeah. You know, and I feel like you and I are here, as you say, having a conversation now, a white man and a black woman, about this issue. So I feel like my hope is that the book sparks these kinds of conversations. White people absolutely have to be able to have them, not just with black people, but with each other.
Yes, exactly.
The book opens with a section that I love called Liminal Spaces One. And you've decided that you don't, in the course of your life, have just kind of natural, casual conversations with white men. And you decide that you're going to try and engage in these conversations with people. And tell us where you decided to do that and set us up a little bit for what that section is about.
Well, that piece originally ran in the New York Times, and I had taught a class at Yale called The Construction of Whiteness. And my students often went off and interviewed suitemates and friends about whiteness. And I thought, well, who am I not talking to? Who am I not in conversation with? And despite my husband being white and, you know, some of our friends being white, I don't have that kind of casualness with white men in the world. So I thought my challenge would be to approach men I didn't know. And because I travel so much, the place where I spend the most amount of time pre-COVID was on planes, sitting next to people for like 7 hours or, you know, and saying, you know, maybe some pleasantries, but often not having any real conversation. And so I made it my, you know, goal something, challenge. I challenged myself to sort of strike up these conversations where race, whiteness, privilege, male privilege became the subject in the conversation. And it took a little time. And, you know, at first I was shy and I was, it felt awkward, but finally I got around to beginning to ask these men about their privilege, and the piece documents that.
Yes. And you get all kinds of reactions from people who sort of want to deny that they have white privilege. You have some encounters that are outright unpleasant. The fellow who steps in front of you in the line for first class and doesn't seem to even see you.
Mm-hmm.
And another conversation that you document where you've had a good conversation, but he writes to you later and basically admits that he had sort of misrepresented things about his hometown and his childhood, that there was a sort of simmering racial tension that ran underneath the placid surface of his hometown. Did you feel, in having all these various kinds of conversations, did you get from it what you wanted to? Did you get out of it what you hoped to get out of it?
That's a hard question, because I don't think I had a hope in the sense of I was at point A and I wanted to arrive at point B. I was curious, and I was curious about the world of these men, as well as my own response to them, you know, what I could hold as a listener. So in as much as I had the conversations, I would say I got out of it what I went to get, which was the conversation itself. But how the conversations went, I couldn't have anticipated them. So I didn't, you know, each one went very differently and asked different things of me as an interlocutor and as a listener. What surprised me was not achieved in the conversations themselves, but afterwards. So in the third documented conversation, that man, he ended up ordering my books online, reading my work, getting in touch with me. And he and his wife and me and my husband met in Manhattan and had dinner and have continued our relationship since then. When the piece was published in The Times, I received over 200 letters from men saying, you know, this is how I think you got it wrong, or I don't think you have a real sense of what my life has looked like. And these were letters that were like, you know, I could have been Emily Dickinson. And because they were pages and pages of descriptions, often ending with a phone number saying, you can call me and talk to me. And then on the New York Times website, there were many, many, many more reactive responses to the piece. So that was interesting. That's when I made the realization and really understood that when I say white privilege, white men often hear economic privilege. And I'm actually just talking about the privilege to be able to live your life, to have an encounter with the police and the police say, you know, all right, this is what you need to do rather than kill me. Or yeah, to go to a store and to be able to just go down an aisle, pick something up, pay for it, and leave without somebody following me. So I, you know, white privilege to me really is about the ability to live, to move around without an obvious surveillance happening. And that could end, as in George Floyd's case, with your death. But when these white men, for the most part, heard the words, the phrase white privilege, they were hearing economic privilege. So what I was getting were letters saying, you know, my parents worked really hard, I didn't have a lot of money, and really just taking for granted the notion that you could wake up in your own house and have somebody break down the door and shoot you, as in the case of Breonna Taylor and many other people. So that was what I learned.
Yeah.
So now I'm very careful when I say, I often say, when I use white privilege, I'm talking about the ability to live, just yeah, live your life.
I don't know if you've read Isabel Wilkerson's new book, Caste. I just read it. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think a very interesting companion to yours. But she really tries to look at, she tries to put a different lens, as not unlike you do, on the issue. And she sort of says that race in America is almost treated as a separate caste, as it is in India with the untouchables, and that it's not necessarily an economic thing, but it's keeping people in the place where white people, where the superior caste expects them to be. And when people break out of that or threaten it in some way, it sends white people around the bend.
I don't think you have to break out of it to be sent around the bend. Mm. I think there are white people who are just irritated by the presence of black people, period. You know, and as we've seen in a number of the Karen videos that have been making the rounds recently, I think there is a real sense in this country that segregation is how life should look. And, you know, George Wallace, segregation today, tomorrow, forever. But there, you know, that spaces in and of themselves, neighborhoods, schools, are white spaces. That's the presumption. So you arrive in those spaces, you are somehow breaking the thing. You know, when you think about Robin DiAngelo talks about how, I believe it's Robin DiAngelo who talks about how a broken school is one where black children attend. A broken neighborhood is one where black people live.
De facto.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, one of the things you write in the book, I jotted this down. If white people don't see their whiteness, how can they speak to it? And I think in some ways, maybe that's what you're talking about here. These guys who would write you letters and say, well, I wasn't economically privileged, but they actually just couldn't see the privilege, as many of us don't as white people, the privilege that whiteness affords us in the world. You know, it's almost this thing that you're able to coast along on it until someone brings it to your attention or it's taken away from you or what have you. But that suggests to me that a lot of the work has to be done, you know, by white people really grappling with this idea that our race gives us a privilege that we don't always see, but exists and operates in the world.
Exactly. I think it seems like a small ask, but for some reason it is disconcerting for white Americans to understand that the systems were set up to enable their white people's advancement in this world. You know, one easy way to even look at it and think about it is immigration laws in the world. Look how long it took for certain segments of the population to achieve citizenship versus white Anglo-Saxon men in 1790, in the 1790 Immigration Act, which said that, you know, the people who were allowed to vote and own property were white Anglo-Saxon men. And so Italians, Greeks, all kinds of people from the Mediterranean, all kinds of people were fighting to get into this umbrella of whiteness. And now that they, you know, the black Irish have made it in, the black Italians have made it in, you know, then it gets shut down and everyone forgets that this was not de facto for them.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the things, Claudia, I wanted to ask you was just about, which I love in the book, is the way in which you're always, I want to say angling, but that sounds somehow too conniving, but you're always looking to push that conversation you're having a little bit farther, to turn the rock over and see what's underneath it. And one of the things that you say often kind of derails these conversations that are so important is this sense of false civility. You know, that people want to be polite. They don't want to go to that uncomfortable place. And you give the example, which I love, of the dinner party where I forget exactly specifically what's being discussed, but the issue of race and white privilege comes up. And there's a woman who suddenly just deflects the entire conversation onto the dessert tray. Some brownies have been brought on out on a silver tray. And she just derails the conversation and says, what lovely brownies. This is something I think you see happen a lot in these conversations.
Yeah, I think civility is the thing that we have seen used to cover over the portal into real conversations about reality, you know? So in that particular dinner party, we were talking about the presidency and how it is that our current president came to power. And somebody at the party was writing a book, and he said it was economic. And I said, well, first of all, capitalism is racism. And secondly, you cannot, you know, he ran on racist ideology. So no one who voted for him can claim that his continued white nationalist rhetoric is a surprise. He was very clear. He said, I'm a nationalist, use that word. So that became a little bit heated. And then this woman, this white woman at the dinner party just said, how lovely the brownies look. And sure, I was being a little bit provocative, but I also was a little irritated when I said to her, are you trying to silence me? Are you shutting down this conversation? And clearly, if the ramifications of that is that I have never been invited to that house again. Because rudeness, apparently, is worse than deflection. So, you know, what can you do?
But you know, and you write about this, you were looking to keep that moment authentic and for people to be able to use the word hold a lot. And I like that. It's sort of, you're testing the friendship and trying to hold the differences and the agreements there and for people to deal with them. But it's challenging.
It's challenging, but I feel like, you know, I've been challenged my entire life. I have been holding a lot of racist statements directed my way inside friendships, inside jobs. I've been continuing to work with people, though they have said very belittling and dismissive things to me. And I have managed to negotiate those and come to work the next day or pick up the phone the next time the person calls. And yet, whenever I make the invitation to think about whiteness and think about how racism is at play in our interactions, then I become the bad guy. And with no recognition that I have been holding, receiving, having to metabolize these assaults, whether they're directed at me or in the society at large, for a lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. As I was reading the book, there were moments where I was like, oh, she's going too far. She's pushing it too hard. But I ultimately came to feel that you were really, that you were almost, as you say, just said, you were asking of people to give as much to you as you give to them in a way, and to meet you on that ground. And
I'm curious, what's a moment that you felt I was pushing it too hard?
Some of the dinner party scene might be one, you know, I mean, that was literally just an instinctual reaction. Like, people are at this dinner party. Do they, you know, maybe they don't want to be challenged. Maybe, I think part of it is that I would feel so uncomfortable myself ever pushing that in that way, you know, because I'm socialized and to be quiet about those things as I think we all are. So I think that was one moment I'm thinking of. I didn't feel, you know, you have the friend who you go to see Fairview with, the play. And I love that passage. You've gone to see the play, and at the end of the play, there's a call to the audience, the white members of the audience, to come on stage. And I should let you tell it because you wrote it and you lived it. Could you explain briefly what that situation was?
Well, I will, but I want to go back a little bit to what you said initially about, you know, you were about to say, I am well socialized.
Yeah.
So I felt the dinner party was to break the laws of civility around socialization for a dinner party might be pushing it too far. But, you know, I think that when he insisted on the fact that it was all economics, that was a moment when I was being the violence that's being done against Black people in the society was being erased. And to me, you know, I also was well socialized growing up, but it doesn't I was very conscious in my insistence on that because I wanted to say you can't erase a reality that is very dangerous for immigrants, for Black people, for women, that, you know, over 60% of white men voted into power. Yes, I understood the whole piece is about what it means to break the laws of civility. I understood I was breaking those laws. But, you know, I think we have to stop feeling like good manners are better than recognizing the inequities and inhumanity that is being brought to huge segments of the society.
Yeah.
So that I will just say that to that. But to the fear view, I was just speaking to that friend this morning, actually. And we were talking about what makes a good conversation because she's a philosophy professor. But she and I, we went to see Fairview. And Fairview is a play that looks at what white people project onto Black people. And the play makes this ask at the end where it says to the white members of the audience, will you give up your seats for a few minutes and stand on stage so that the people of color in the audience can hold this by themselves for a minute, that they can have in the space of the audience something that's not in the world, a space that's just for them, that you both share, but you've given up your seat. It's almost like a kind of soft reparations, you know, yeah. And you go stand on. And my white friend who attended the play with me, when they asked the white people to go on stage, she refuses to go. And I can't say to her, you must go, but I'm sitting there waiting for her to do what what they have asked her to do. And she refuses to do it. And as I'm sitting there, I find myself getting more and more and more enraged by her refusal, because it feels to me like such a soft and, in a sense, meaningless ask. And yet even that she refuses. So the piece examines sort of my own emotional, heightened emotional feelings around that. And I write it out. And I discuss it with my therapist, actually, afterwards. I actually employed a therapist for this book. I went out, I found a therapist, and I said, you know, what I would like us to do together is I'm going to write these pieces for the book, and I would like to discuss them with you. And if you could help me understand why I react in the ways that I react and why you think the white people react in the ways that they react or other people react in the ways that... we can discuss those things, and I will fold that into the essay. And she agreed. And so after I wrote it out, I brought it to the shrink. We discussed it. And then once I wrote the piece out, I send the piece to a fact checker, which I also employed for this project. And he and I fact checked any references in the piece. Then I had a lawyer look at the pieces. And she responded in different places. And then I gave the piece back to the person I had the conversation with. And in this case, this friend. And I said, you know, this is, you know, my understanding and my memory of what happened between us on the day we went to see Fairview. What do you think? And do you want to write a response? And so she read the piece, and as it says in the book, she said, this is what I said, this is what you said, but it's not what I intended. And so she then wrote out what she was feeling during that time. And that becomes part of the piece.
Yeah, it's intense. And I really liked the fact that you asked her about it. You know, you said, I'm going to have a conversation about this. Here's this thing that enraged you and seemed incomprehensible. You know, so many friendships, I think, would either founder on something like that or it would get glossed over. And you asked her to account for it and you told her what your feelings were about the situation. So I feel like it was a really honest transaction, and it sounds as though the friendship is maybe stronger for it in some ways.
I think so. I mean, I think we are very different people and have very different orientations in the world and beliefs in the world. I mean, she just recently wrote a piece about attending a Defund the Police rally and then feeling at a certain point she needed to go up to the police and tell them that she didn't agree with everything that was being asked for in the signs. And the other women she went with were enraged. They were like, why are you feeling like you need to do this right now? So she's somebody who is very, I think, aware of her own limits in terms of what she will and will not do, and is willing to engage the engagement. So in that way, I feel very lucky with our friendship, because nothing is left unaddressed.
Yeah. God, Claudia, I mean, we could talk all day, I feel. This subject is so, it's vital. And your approach to it, to me, just recasts it and makes me think about it in a different way than I'm used to thinking about it, which really is provocative, but also, you know, meaningful to me. But I guess I just wanted to ask you one thing, which was, this book is coming out at such an extraordinary moment. You know, you wrote all these pieces that are in the book before George Floyd, before the protests. I assume they were written, before the protests this summer.
Yeah. No, they weren't. I mean, the book was in production a year, you know, in the last year.
Yeah. And so I guess I'm wondering for you, what does it mean to have just us coming out into this moment? And how do you see what's going on? Is there a different kind of a conversation happening in America because of the protests and the large numbers of people that have come out to say this is not right?
Well, I think this is, in a way, the perfect climate for Just Us. It's one where people are open to understanding the inequities. I mean, we've had some tragic and horrible things like the killing of Floyd, but also the Amy Cooper video for me is one of the most striking moments of the last few months as well, because we have somebody in Amy Cooper who knows the right language, African-American, excuse me, I'm going to call the police now. You know, she talk about civility.
Yeah.
The height of civility.
Yeah.
You know, excuse me, I will call the police now. And yet, extremely capable of weaponizing the narratives of white femininity in service of the possible death of African Americans. So I think that we are in an extraordinary moment, extraordinary, pushed by the executive branch and the Senate into having to accept the fakeness, the fake news, the fabrications, the rejection of science, the rejection of inequities, or take on the world that's in front of us. And, you know, and what we've seen in Portland, what we've seen during the protests across the country, is that for the first time, people are saying, we're ready to take on the world in front of us. And in order to achieve systemic change inside the various institutions and systems that we have, we're going to have to start one-to-one. We're going to have to start speaking to each other with a shared vocabulary, a shared understanding, a shared recognition of American history. And so I cannot think of a better time to begin to think about having conversations.
I can't either. And I really am convinced this book will play a role in all of that, because it just, it really turns over so many preconceived notions, and you offer almost an example really of how to do this. So thank you for the book, Claudia. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Fully Booked, and best of luck with the book out in the world.
Thank you, Tom, and stay safe, wear your mask, vote, do all the things that I'm going to do.
Good, I will. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Wow, Tom, that was an incredible conversation.
Claudia is really something. I was super excited to do this interview with her. Also super nervous because conversations were the subject of the book.
Right.
And I knew I had to bring my A game in the sense of she's such an incredible listener and she really listens to what people say and hears it and analyzes it sort of on the spot. So I was like, you know, I have to come, I have to listen to her, but I also have to think about what I say. There's no such thing as a careless conversation with Claudia Rankine. But I really enjoyed it. And I just, the thing I loved about her was just her humor, her intelligence, her thoughtfulness. It was, to me, just a great all-time experience.
Well, I think that all of this, I think you both brought your A game that day. And I think that that really comes through to me, a listener, at least. And I am especially pleased and particularly grateful that she and you discussed that play Fairview, because that was a scene from the book that really, really stuck with me.
Yeah. And the friend who, you know, the white friend who, when the white people in the audience are asked to leave the audience and come up on stage, who doesn't go. And Claudia is just sitting there waiting for her to move and not doing it and wondering what she should say. It's intense, right? It was like a weirdly edge of your seat passage in the book.
And if you bring your, you know, like if I bring my social prejudices to that, I'd be like, oh, well, we're not friends anymore. But like, well, you know, one thing this shows time and again is she keeps the conversation going, you know,
always.
And it's not just as simple as these one-off interactions, you know, and it can't be, it mustn't.
Yeah. And she's, you know, the friend writes to her after the fact and sort of explains how she was thinking. And I think Claudia writes in the book that this is why we are friends, because she's always engaged. She's always willing to go back to revisit, to rethink, and to talk about it some more. And I hope all of us get to keep having a conversation with Claudia Rankine. She's just brilliant.
What I just like personally, I'd love to know, what is there anything else that springs to mind? Like what else are you taking away from this experience?
You know, I think the thing that I really learned, I really liked this notion that you are holding a bunch of different things. She uses that term holding in the book, and I think she used it in our conversation too. Holding a lot of different complex, sometimes contradictory things in your relationship with a person and in a conversation with a person. And to be present for all those things and to really be able to live with the contradictions in them. At the same time, not to be silent, you know, and to speak up. I mean, I said to her, you know, I'm too well socialized to call out somebody. And she said to me, well, I'm well socialized too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's absolutely right. Like, if you are going to move forward, which is what we want to do, we want to have process, you do have to be willing to speak up against this social pressure you have to be polite and civil and nice. And I hope she gave me a little bit more courage to do that.
Well, I'm thrilled that we're able to feature your conversation together on this podcast. One more time, Claudia's book is called Just Us, An American Conversation. And after the break, we'll be joined by our editors with their top picks and books this week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books this week. We have nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, fiction editor Lori Muchnick, and editor-in-chief Tom Beer. Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon are out of the office today. Starting with nonfiction, Eric, what's your choice for us?
My choice is a book called Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. It's by Michael Denzel Smith. One of my favorite books of the year. I think it does an amazing job of So Smith is a young Black journalist, and he kind of surveys the landscape and gets behind a lot of the myths of the American dream. And especially with what has happened this past week, I think this book speaks to a lot of the stuff that is going on, especially as it relates to race. It's one of the most kind of concise but powerful diagnoses I've seen probably in a couple years, since maybe Ta-Nehisi Coates' last book. But I just want to read a little bit of it. He has this amazing ability to kind of dig beneath the surface without really digressing. He's very good at seeing what is going on and being direct about what is needed, what is wrong, and what is needed. So I'm just going to read a little passage here. It says, quote, "As Americans, we are eager, ravenous even, to believe the most flattering narratives about ourselves. They don't have to be true. The hand-wringing over the age of alternative facts rings hollow when the history teach is built on them. Bemoaning the lack of truth from our elected officials suggests that Americans have never actually been concerned about truth as such. We've only ever cared that we are made to feel good about ourselves as Americans. We like our independence from the British, our defeat of fascism in Germany and Japan, our first man on the moon, our Cold War victory. Those parts of our history that do not straighten our backs are either ignored or distorted to the point that they would be unrecognizable to the people who lived through them." So that's a little taste of kind of what he's getting at. So it's an excellent history lesson. Explodes many, many, many myths about the quote unquote American dream and who actually has access to it. You know, I couldn't recommend it enough, especially right now.
Eric, I was reading our review of the book before I came to the recording session, and I noticed that the reviewer said he actually pointed to the 1972 presidential race of Shirley Chisholm as kind of a, I guess, a high point of a Black woman, child of immigrants, engaged in the political process and running for president. I just thought that was so fascinating. I've always thought that was a really interesting chapter in American history.
It is, and it's one that's kind of been overlooked, but is now being revived, thankfully. And he does an excellent job of that.
The title is Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream by Michael Denzel Smith. Thanks, Eric, for that choice. Next, we've got Fiction with Lori. Lori, what's your pick?
I recommend Transcendent Kingdom by Yah Jesse, who you may remember as the author of Homegoing, which was a big hit a few years ago. This book is very different. Homegoing took place over seven generations in one family, beginning in Ghana in the mid-18th century, you know, and sort of one chapter about each generation of the family. This is more of a deep dive into the life of one woman, Gifty, who's a 28-year-old doctoral student in neuroscience at Stanford School of Medicine. And at the beginning of the book, her mother has just arrived to stay with her because she's having a very serious depressive episode for the second time in her life. And her pastor back in Alabama kind of put her on a plane and sent her out to California to live with her daughter, who is trying to reckon with her mother's depression, and which was set off the first time many years ago when Gifty's older brother, the firstborn son and kind of favorite in the family, died of an overdose after having become addicted to opioids after he was taking some for pain after an injury, which Gifty also kind of tells herself has nothing to do with the fact that she's doing this scientific research into what makes lab mice reckless and what, you know, how do they create restraint in mice. So the book talks a lot about her scientific research, and also her mother is a very religious person and she is not, so gets into questions of religion and family. For a book that's very deeply goes into this one character, it's also, like Homegoing, each individual chapter is quite short. It's only a few pages long, so it has a real rhythm of moving along and, you know, popping in to a particular like day in Gifty's life and then moving on in the next chapter. But it's beautifully written and very just grapples with a lot of big questions.
Yeah, I was happy to see this. I enjoyed Homegoing, and I always love when novelists can avoid that sophomore slump, which is a real thing a lot of times. And I like that she's kind of, what the reviewer says, pivots toward intimacy. And so I think it's impressive that in her second novel, she can go that direction after covering seven generations yeah. in this kind of more expansive way. And then kind of upping the ante on the concision in her second novel.
Yeah, it's very impressive and well done.
So I look forward to that one. Thank you.
The title of the book is Transcendent Kingdom. It's by Ya Jesse. Thank you, Lori, for that pick. And finally, we have Editor-in-Chief Tom Beer with his pick for the week.
Thanks, Megan. My pick is a nonfiction pick this week. It's a book called Vesper Flights by Helen MacDonald. Many of you will remember MacDonald was a finalist for the Kirkus Prize in 2015 for her memoir, H is for Hawk, and which has got to be one of my favorite books of the last 10 years, hands down. And the new book is a collection of essays. A lot of these she wrote for the New York Times Magazine. Some of them she wrote for the New Statesman. And she says in the introduction that her subject in the book is love, love for the glittering world of non-human life around us. And as she did in H is for Hawk, she's so good at describing the natural world, describing animals and birds in particular, but also in really surprising and unexpected ways, connecting them to humans, to human behavior, to our perceptions of them. A couple of essays, one she has that's just about birds' nests and what they mean and what they suggest to us and how birds build them and how they compile them out of human refuse and also natural, natural material. And she just cycles through all these different sort of metaphorical and literal readings of what a nest is. And it's just stunning. And then I think possibly my favorite essay in the book is called High Rise, where she goes to the top of the Empire State Building with an ornithologist and is there with a pair of binoculars. And she writes about how, many of us think of the sky as empty the same way people used to think of the ocean as empty. But in fact, the sky is a natural habitat full of birds and bats and insects and seeds. And she kind of just reframes the whole thing for you. And suddenly you're seeing the sky and what's in it in a completely different way. And it's just pure Helen MacDonald, and she's wonderful. And the book is wonderful.
That sounds so great, Tom. I'm not sure I've ever read a whole book about nature, but since we've been quarantining and more than most people, I think, I haven't really gone anywhere. And I've just become fascinated by the nature in my backyard. And, I feel like the birds are messengers from other places. And I, started noticing much more than I ever did when we see the same birds, when we see different birds. And actually, we had a couple of doves, I think, make a nest in our backyard. And we watched the little birds learn to fly and stuff. And it was fascinating. So this book, I can't wait to read.
I think you'll like it. She actually writes one essay that's sort of all about this meadow that she knew as a girl and that she used to sort of run to this meadow and study it and sort of going back to revisit it many years later and just what it's like to spend so much time in a place observing and learning. And I think the other reason you'll just love her, Lori, is that she's like just a peerless prose writer. I mean, they're just breathtaking sentences and turns of phrase in the book. I can't recommend it enough.
I loved H is for Hawk, and I can't wait to read this. Thank you so much, Tom, for suggesting Vesper Flights by Helen MacDonald. Okay, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you all very much for joining us today. Please join us again next week when my guest will be novelist Vanessa Veselka. Her second novel is called The Great Offshore Grounds, and I can't wait to discuss it with her then. But until that time, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.